UK Wine Show, show number 143. Lebanese wine with Ali Mamari. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 143 for the 13th of February 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's wine show, we're talking with Ali Mamari from Kezar Winery in Lebanon. We're going to be talking with him about Lebanese wine, the regions, and some of the unusual history associated with Lebanese wine. In the spotlight, we review the book Choosing the Right Wine, a teach-yourself book by Beverly Blanning. And in this week's quote, wine is a food, a medicine, and a poison. It's just a question of dosage. Who said that? But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Following heat waves and long periods of drought across Australian vineyards, the Yarra Valley wine region near Melbourne has been severely affected by the bushfires that have devastated parts of Victoria this week. The Roundstone Winery and Restaurant has been burnt to the ground, and other Yarra wineries, including Domain Chandon, Lance Family Vineyards and Punt Road, were partially damaged.
I was planning on reporting on the heat wave, which was going to cause a lot of problems to the Australian harvest. The grapes were ripe and raisining on the vine, but the flavours weren't yet developed. Now with the heat came the fire. The death rate is high and climbing, so not a pleasant thing at all. And it's not just the vineyards that have been burnt that are damaged. Fire causes smoke, and the smoke will taint many of the wines, dropping the value of the vines and grapes that are saved. With drought and fire, it's tough being an Australian winemaker at the moment. What's next, Jane?
Next up, the Bordeaux and Bordeaux Superior Union is seeking permission from the INAO, that's the National Institute of Appellations, to test grape varieties which are all currently illegal in the production of Bordeaux wines. If the trials get the go-ahead, the varieties, which include Chardonnay, Syrah, Zinfandel and Chenin Blanc, will be planted in up to 8 different locations and trialled over 8 years, 3 years prior to the first harvest and 5 years of harvesting. That's before getting approval under the appellation laws. The grapes in the trial can be used in a wine blend and then sold, with a maximum of 30% in the final blend being used. The aim is to test which grapes work best on which terroir in the region, with the intention of introducing them only if they offer real quality. The results may also help the region in its planning for climate change. The red grapes for trial will be Marsalan, Syrah, Zinfandel and Arenanoa. In white, Lily Orilla, Chardonnay, Petit Monson Blanc and Chenin Blanc will be tested. The INAO will decide at the end of February whether to permit tests of the varieties.
Well, that's quite a few new varieties. Already Bordeaux can grow more grape varieties than most people realise. They can grow Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, Carmenere and Malbec for the reds. With Petit Verdot and Malbec, they were quite common before Phylloxera, but they weren't really replaced after that. For the whites, you've got Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon and Muscadel are the major white varieties. Other varieties can be used as long as they don't make up more than between 15 and 30%. These include Uni Blanc, Edenic, Colombard, Marsac and Merlot Blanc. Quite a few new varieties there. Perhaps they should be looking at new varieties instead of what they're doing to the US, Jane. What's going on there?
Well, another wine scandal has emerged, this time involving fraudulent wine made in the Aude region of Languedoc-Roussillon, after the regional wine office spotted a discrepancy in the figures of Pinot Noir production versus exports. Over 120,000 hectolitres of Van de Pay DOC has been sold and exported to the US over the last 4 years, falsely labelled as Pinot Noir. The Aude region only produces 50,000 hectolitres of Pinot Noir a year, but the wine fetches double the standard price for red wine from the region. The wine was sold to the US via negociants and wine companies, but it's not clear where in the chain the fraud took place. Although no formal charges have been made, a trial is expected. That's all from me this week, but don't forget these stories on our website www.3050.co.uk.
Oh well, another day, another wine fraud in Europe. Perhaps one way of avoiding a bit of wine fraud is to know more about wine. Next up, we're going to be reviewing the book Choosing the Right Wine by Beverly Blanning. It's part of the Teach Yourself books. Personally, I've never read a Teach Yourself book before, but this 236-page book has got me thinking about what other topics I'd like to know more about. While most books either look at how to taste wines or talk about wine regions and grape varieties in great length, this book does more than just covering wine regions. What I like about it is there is much more to wine than regions and grape varieties, and this excellent book covers most of them. The writing is straightforward, but the cover and lack of pictures didn't fill me with a lot of confidence when I first opened it up. But once I started reading it, I realized that an excellent book. Beverly writes an engaging, if slightly dry style, but I found choosing the right wine to be an easy and enjoyable read for such a factual book. And while the book can be dipped into for topics that interest you, it's suitable for reading cover to cover, which is what I did. The book is divided into four sections: an introduction, the flavors in wine, wines of the world, and the final section on buying, serving, and storing wine. On the surface, it looks like many other wine books you read, but it's the level of information that's included that I felt made it stand out as an excellent book. The tips in the book are very good, sensible, practical, and gives you some advice on wines to try to get a general idea of different styles of wine. The only downside is the book's name, Choosing the Right Wine, is a bit misleading, as it only covers choosing wine in the last couple of chapters. That's chapter 14 of the book. To read this book, it does take a bit of time and should only be read by anybody really interested in wine. There's a lot of lighter, fluffier books to read if you've just got a passing interest in wine. However, if you're an enthusiastic amateur or in the trade, then this is an excellent book. Those with formal wine qualifications, such as the WSET diploma, should pretty much know everything that's covered in the book. However, it's an excellent resource if you've done one of the other WSET courses below their diploma level, or if you're thinking about doing the WSET course, I'd recommend it. My only regret about the book is that I didn't read it about 5 years ago when it would have been really most useful. It would have saved me a lot of hard research. In the end, I gave this book a very high score of 91 out of 100, and I would strongly recommend it as an excellent all-round wine book. That ends this week's Look in the Spotlight. Next week, we're going to use some of the knowledge we gained from looking at our senses last month, and we're going to see how we can better understand wine and food matching. We start, however, with a general overview of wine and food matching. And the next book we'll be reviewing on the show in about a month's time is The Wine Diet by Professor Roger Corder. I read it a year or so ago when it first came out and thought I'd read it again and review it. Actually, I got this week's quote from The Wine Diet, although I've known the quote for a while, but I was never sure who actually said it first. The quote was, "Wine is a food, a medicine, and a poison. It's just a question of dosage." Now, who said that? We are talking about a 16th century European physician who pioneered the use of chemicals and minerals in medicine. Although his views on science and medicine are wildly different to today's understanding, being interested in toxicology, he came up with lots of similar quotes, such as, "All things are poison and nothing is without poison. Only the dose permits something not to be poisonous." Any ideas who said that, or even which European country it's from? Now, he may have consumed wines, but it's unlikely to have drunk Lebanese wine. Next up, we're going to be talking with Ali Marmory from Khazar Wines. We find out about the history and why our famous physician may not have tried Lebanese wine, as well as the sub-regions in Lebanon. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Ali Marmory. You're from Khazar Winery in Lebanon. How are you, mate?
Fine, thank you.
We're at a very busy Fakhreddin, is that how you pronounce it, restaurant in...
Fakhreddin.
Fakhreddin restaurant in London, so there might be a bit of background noise as we go through the tasting. But how are you, mate?
Fine, thank you.
Excellent. Good. You've just done a presentation to myself about Lebanon and Lebanese wine industry. Is there a way of putting Lebanese wine into a nutshell? Is there a way of simply defining Lebanese wine?
Yeah, sure. Well, Lebanon have been producing wine since a very, very long time. Since the Phoenician, they started the vine growing and the wine making in the Lebanon. And then came the Greco-Roman era, where they built the first and the largest temple dedicated for Bacchus, the god of wine.
Yep.
Which is at 27 kilometers away from the winery.
The Phoenicians, when was that? How long
ago? Well, the finishing, that was 4,000 years ago.
4,000 years ago, so quite a few years ago.
Exactly. So we've been producing wine for a very, very long time ago. And then came the Byzantine era also that spread it and continued spreading the wine growing. And then the Christianity, where Jesus Christ achieved his first miracle in Cana, which is in South Lebanon, when he turned water into wine during the wedding of Cana.
I heard that Noah, in your presentation, you mentioned Noah.
Yes, Noah was the first vine grower and winemaker, and he lived into this region on the Mount Lebanon, and did his wine in this region. Then after the Christianity came the Islamic era with Abu Nawas, the very famous poet who only sang about wine and its virtuosity and its advantages. And
I thought wine wasn't exactly encouraged under Muslim traditions.
Well, it wasn't, but Abu Nawas was one of a kind and is a very famous poet, and he used to sing for the wines. And
excellent. Yeah. So that brings up to what we've done the Greek Roman times, the big temple in Bacchus temple, and what happened between say the 400 AD right through to sort of 1800s.
So we unfortunately Lebanon is not anymore famous for its wine, although it was mentioned in the Bible, it was mentioned in the Torah about the Lebanon wines and Lebanon grapes. It's in the Hosea chapter, you can find it in the Hosea chapter, speaking about the vines of Lebanon, three times. But this was due, this cut was due to the presence of the Ottoman in Lebanon for almost 500 years. Mm. Where no more production of wine were permitted, and only some monasteries had the right to make some sweet wines for the mass celebration, and some white and red wines for their own consumption. So that's why we have lost all our autochthon grape varieties, unfortunately. And then it's the Jesuits who started bringing it. It was in 1857 when they acquired the estate of Xara. And they started this vine growing again.
Okay. The Ottoman Empire is quite an interesting one. We won't really delve into it. But they didn't encourage winemaking. They were Muslim.
Exactly. They were Muslim. They did encourage the production of wine. Although they continued in their country, in Turkey, they continued the vine growing and the wine making, but it was forbidden in Lebanon and in Syria. They were in both countries.
Okay, and the Ottoman Empire fell at World War I, really, wasn't it?
Exactly. They left Lebanon in 1918. They were driven out of Lebanon by the French and the English, yeah, who came to Lebanon and to the Bekaa, and they stayed in this region, in the Rayak region, which is 10 kilometers away from Xara.
Okay, now Bekaa region is probably the most famous region in Lebanon for producing wines.
Exactly.
Is there wines produced anywhere else before we drill into the Bekaa region?
Yes, almost 65% of the production of Lebanon is done is grown in the Bekaa Valley. And then you have some in the northern part of Lebanon and in Mount Lebanon. A small part in Mount Lebanon, 6 to 7%.
Okay, and what's the region called North Lebanon?
North Lebanon, meaning Byblos and its region. Jbeil, we call it in Lebanese, or Byblos in English. And it's surrounding. So it's at between 400 and 600 meters of altitude. Mm-hmm. While the Bekaa is, the lowest part is 900 meters and could go up to 1100 meters in the Baalbek region.
See, that's the interesting thing about Lebanese wine is it does appear to be all at altitude. What sort of latitude is Lebanon at?
That's a very good question. We're not very high in latitude. We are 32 to 33 in latitude. So we're not very high on this. This is almost the limit. Yeah. So we compensate the lack of latitude by the altitude. So that's why our vineyards are grown in altitude. 900 meters is the lowest in the Bekaa, but we do not grow in the plain, so we grow on slopes. So our vineyards start at 1,100 meters till 1,400 meters of altitude.
Why do you not grow on the valley floor?
We do not grow in the Valley Fro because of the mediocre quality of the wines, because they have a lot of rain. And as you know, in the plain, all the water would stay in this plain. So they have reserve, and the roots would not go very deeply since they have a lot of water on this. So that's why we choose to put it on the slopes. There's another reason, which is an economical reason. Just for the vines, you need poor soils. And when you have poor soils, they cannot grow tomatoes, they cannot grow other crops. So that's why they use it for growing the vines. So if you have water in your soil and that all on the plain, you'll never grow vines, which is suitable for us also.
Yeah, so all the sort of the more wet areas are used for other types of agriculture, and use the slopes that are got probably less rain.
No, it has the same quantity of rainfall, but the water does not stay. So that's why some of our vineyards, we have terraces for the vineyards. Some of them, they don't have, if the slope is not too strong, we don't have terraces on these vineyards. But we have an average of 650 to 700 millimeter of rainfall, and we have an average of 2 to 3 weeks of snow on the plain, which creates the reserve. And then
the reserve, you mean the water?
The reserve of water, yes. And next to that, we have two series of mountains that surrounds the valley, the Bekaa Valley. And on those series of mountains, we have snow up to 2, 3, 4 months sometimes. And this will create the other reserve. As the snow melts, it goes down to the valley, and by going down, it irrigates the slopes and irrigates the vineyards.
Okay, so you, water, particularly in the... Because in your presentation, you mentioned that the rain falls mainly in the winter months anyway.
Well, it starts in late October, beginning of November. Now we have a storm. We are by almost the end of November. We had 3 days storm and still continuing. So we had some snow on the on these mountains that I told you about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. I was reading, and what you have said is that it's very dry during the summer months, and with a really, and there was also a breeze, a consistent breeze. Is it usually quite windy through the Bekaa, or at least
it is? It is very dry, extremely dry. To give you an order in numbers, it's almost 42 to 43 percent of humidity, which is very very dry. You can consider it comparing to Beirut, which have 80 to 85 percent. So you go out in Beirut, you sweat immediately, while you can walk for an hour in the Bekaa, although it is hotter. Yep. The temperature is hotter, but you do not sweat. And dry climate does not permit for the mushrooms or for the bacteria to develop. So, which is very good. And then we have another thing, which is the wind that we have that blows from the north and goes down to the south. You have it the whole day, and at the approach of night, it calms down.
Does it interfere with your flowering, though? Because
no, it's not a strong wind.
It's just a nice
breeze that still continues. But this dries all the... if you have some water, it dries it out.
Sure. It sounds like if you've got really cold winters with snow and then dry summers, disease pressure must be, even not just molds and mildews, but also from pests and diseases.
Exactly. That's very true. The best pesticide that you can have is the frost, the winter frost. That's the best pesticide you can have. It kills all the pesticide and any spores that are in the tree. They will die out because of this frost. So we don't have to treat our vine that much. We can consider our vine as grown naturally. We cannot call them as grown biologic.
Organic.
Because we do not have the label. But we are, through the UVL and through the National Academy that we're making, we are going to apply for a biologic label.
I noticed on your website that you talked about you can consider the grapes to be organically grown, but not organic. And I was wondering about whether you were going to go down that route or not. It sounded like
we could be, but you know, it's not easy to go into this field, because this has to pass through a low, and passing through this low is not, it's not easy to make to pass it through the parliament or and through the government.
Oh, so you haven't got the legislation in place for that?
No, we don't have it till yet this legislation, but we're working on it.
It sounds like the region is pretty good for, from a pest disease point of view, dry at the right times of the year, wet at the right times of the year. But Lebanese wine, there's only 21 wineries in Lebanon. Why aren't there loads more? Is it a lack of land or what's going on there?
Exactly, as you said, the lack of land. It's a very small country. It's the whole surface is something like 10,700 square kilometers, which is extremely, extremely small, and a lot of mountains where you cannot plant. So these are the main reasons, and the land is more or less expensive when you compare it to viticulture regions in France or in Italy or in Argentina. So that's why it will develop, but very, very slowly.
Why is the land so expensive? Is it just
because it's a small country and the people are more or less they have money, they're more or less rich. So they buy these lands, they want to build on these lands.
In your presentation you gave a wee while ago, you mentioned that there's a new organization called the UVL that's managing a new type of appellation contrôlée. What's going on there?
Yes, the UVL is short for Union Vinicole du Liban. So this union takes care of the quality of the wines, the grape variety to be planted, what would be the yield, what kind of soil, and to on a later stage the appellation and divide these appellation in the Bekaa Valley. For the moment, we only have one appellation, which is the Bekaa Valley.
What about the north and the Mount Lebanon?
Or the Mount Lebanon. Okay. That's it. The northern doesn't have any appellation yet.
Oh, okay. And how's that being implemented? Is that the UVL, are they just setting a set of rules? Because I've been watching the sort of development of, in Australia and New Zealand, the appellation contrôlée system, if you like, and it seems to be very much driven from the viticulturalists themselves, the winemakers themselves, as opposed to maybe government-led. Is that a similar type of thing with you guys?
Exactly the same thing. It is mostly the vine grower and the winemaker who are studying these eventuality and working on this on these rules in order to put those rules in the benefit of everyone. We do not wish to put just rules to benefit this producer or that producer or this region or that region. So it is a gathering of all the wineries and wine growers.
Mm, okay. In Australia, for example, they don't really have a lot of rules on yields and production and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's more of a French thing. Why have you gone down the route of specifying yields?
Well, you know, as I told you, it's a small country, so we tend to make quality and not quantities, and we cannot make quantities. And it is very, very urgent for us to have rules in order not to have people doing whatever they want. We would not interfere in the grape variety. Like he can grow whatever he likes as grown yield, as grape variety. But the yield should be a little bit controlled. He should not be irrigating in order to make quantity wines. This would be harmless harmful for the notoriety of the Lebanese, because we know very well that this sector would not develop that much. It's very limited in surface, and it's very limited in the placement. So it's better. We saw it's better that to have rules, and it's in accordance with all the vine grower and winemaker.
Okay, then Ellie, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ellie is certainly an old school type of guy, believing in treating vines mean to keep them keen, planting on the hills where the quality of soils are low. I wondered, listening to him, whether some of the belief is because high quality arable land would not be allowed to be used for such frivolous things as wine production. And as vines can grow on poor soils, they're often regulated there. After all, Richard Smart in some of the early shows didn't think that treating a vine mean to keeping it keen was a very true idea. And most of New Zealand's Sauvignon Blanc grown in Marlborough is grown on some very fertile lands, and those wines are fantastic. So I personally am not necessarily a believer in treating vines mean to keep them keen. But interesting that Ellie has that point of view. Next week, we're going to continue talking with Ellie, but this time we're going to be talking about Kazara Winery. And before we close, how are you getting on with the quote? Wine is a food, a medicine, a poison. It's just a question of dosage. Well, it was said by 16th century Swiss physician Paracelsus. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.